Our last speaker is Mr. Jeremy Cantor. And Mr. Cantor is Program Manager at Prevention Institute. He oversees projects related to health equity, community health, land use and health, and health system reform. Major projects he manages includes a health equity training series for community advocates around California, the statewide Healthy Places Coalition, building the economic case for prevention, and operationalizing a community-centered health system. Jeremy received his MPH in health and social behavior from UC Berkeley. And the title of his presentation is A Good Solution Solves Multiple Problems, Integrating AOD Prevention with Community Prevention Efforts.
Thank you, Rhonda, for that introduction, and to all of you for being here. I forgot to put in the disclosure slide, but I have no disclosures to make, financial. Although I do want to acknowledge that I know less about alcohol and drug prevention than anybody in this room, I'm pretty sure. And, you know, when I sat down to think about what I was going to say today, not that long ago, I was sort of trying to figure out exactly why I was coming here and what I was going to talk about. And I realized in thinking about it that actually it was a very similar feeling to the feeling I had when the State Department of Alcohol and Drug Prevention approached me and a couple of my colleagues about a year ago to help them facilitate a project focused on comprehensive prevention. Because that's something I actually do know a fair amount about. And so I wanted to start actually by running through, this is how I make presentations around California and a lot of different places around kind of community prevention, and this is how I often start those presentations, is talking through community scenarios and community factors that shape health to get a dialogue going about the interaction between the community environment and health outcomes. So we talk about advertising and, you know, the relative discrepancy in health budgets to promote healthy choices versus fast food industry, in addition to kind of the, you know, relative appeal or lack of appeal of these posters. This is from Oakland near our office. Built environment factors, ability to get around safely, pedestrian safety, again, traffic safety, bikeability, walkability, advertising, unhealthy products, where these sorts of advertisements show up, who they target, et cetera. Safety within neighborhoods, particularly among children, youth, are they able to get outside, be physically active? This is sort of an interesting, maybe it's positive, maybe it's negative image. And then also, looking at it from a broader perspective, this is a map that was done by the Alameda County Department of Public Health. And actually, many of you have probably seen the Health Happens Here campaign that's featured pretty prominently, which was sort of built on this concept of looking at, looking geographically and by geocoding death certificates, figuring out that there were certain neighborhoods within the county where death rates are much higher or, depending on how you look at, much lower than others. And this plays out, meaning that a child born in West Oakland, an African-American child born in West Oakland, can expect to die almost 15 years earlier than a white person born in the Oakland Hills. Pretty striking. You can do this analysis about virtually every county in the United States. I saw one recently in Marin County, one of the wealthiest counties. Very similar statistics. And in talking with groups and with community activists around the state and the country, these sorts of conversations, alcohol and drug issues come up all the time. Right? I mean, it's obviously one of the factors involved here. So when the State Department of Alcohol and Drug Prevention, ADP, came to us, we realized this is a great opportunity to actually better understand this relationship. We've done a lot of work on nutrition, physical activity, built environment issues that relate to physical activity, in particular in safety, increasingly in health reform. But this was an area that we didn't have a lot of expertise. And I think from their perspective, and actually this is, it's good because Fried Whitman, who's here today, was also in the room and for the meeting that we facilitated, so he can double check me if I get some of the context wrong. From their perspective, I think they invited us in for two reasons. One is that at this particular moment, as is still going on in California, alcohol and drug programs are going to be collapsed into other departments. And I think they realized during this process that there weren't a whole lot of people who had a vested interest in alcohol and drug prevention. The service side, there was a lot of interest and a lot of engagement. On the prevention side, not so much. And so there was a need to kind of define alcohol and drug prevention as part of a broader community prevention landscape. So they were looking for opportunities to link with people who are doing nutrition and physical activity work, tobacco work, so on and so forth. And the second thing is that, related to the first, is that we're in a time of diminishing resources. And so there's a need to be very strategic and think about ways to effectively partner with other sectors, to work together towards common goals, blend funding, all of those sorts of issues. So that's sort of what they asked us to do. So we brought together about 35 people, leaders from local government, state government, different sectors, many of our friends from the nutrition physical activity world, tobacco advocates, et cetera, to have a conversation. And we started kind of we sort of set the context with a few things that we all agreed on. So the majority of costly conditions are preventable. There's a huge need to focus on prevention. And this is, broadly. And there were some people from healthcare institutions who sort of can back this up. Current healthcare spending underemphasizes prevention. This is nationally, and the breakdown, the best evidence indicates that behaviors and environments are vastly the strongest factors influencing health. And then you go to the other side, and prevention is a really small piece of the $2.7 trillion we spend on health. And so there's a real paradox in that. Alcohol and drug abuse is a key determinant of health. And this is actually all really useful information for me and for us. So 1 in 4 Americans will have an alcohol or drug problem at some point in their lives. The cost is $545 a year for each Californian. And the U.S. economy is $600 billion annually in healthcare costs, crime, and lost productivity to alcohol and drug abuse. And the costs associated with substance abuse exceed the costs for both cancer and diabetes. So there's a real case to be made here for focusing on alcohol and drug abuse. There's also a huge amount of evidence, and some of it has been talked about today, about the intersection of alcohol and drug abuse and other issues. So there's a reason for nutrition advocates, mental health advocates, physical activity experts, violence prevention experts to be in the room with people who are looking at alcohol and drug issues. And this is emphasized, looking at national frameworks like the National Prevention Strategy, where drug abuse and alcohol use are there and intersected with other leading health issues and behavioral issues. And lastly, that there's a need to focus on the community environment. Because when you think about that kind of second desire that ADP had, the best place to look for intersections and opportunities to partner and collaborate is at the community level, and is at strategies that are implemented at a community level. I'm going to run through actually a little bit of what we did in this meeting and then some of the findings. So we started with a framework that we've developed called Take Two Steps to Prevention. Not surprisingly, when we see an image like this, the first thing that comes to my mind certainly is healthcare services. There's going to be a need for healthcare services. We want them to be timely, affordable, culturally appropriate, all of that. And that makes sense, and it's absolutely necessary, and we're all going to need those services throughout our lifetimes. But there's also a need to understand what's underlying those crashes. So the presentation you did is a perfect example of this. What's the, where are people being exposed to alcohol? How are these behaviors being shaped? So is there underage drinking going on, binge drinking? This isn't a college thing. I need to understand what's happening there. And there's some really good evidence about the kind of linkages between these exposure and behavior factors and then health outcomes. So this is sort of based on McGinnis and Fagey's groundbreaking work in the 90s, looking at actual causes of death, tracking back from what's on a death certificate to look at these clusters, these actual causes. So if we look specifically at alcohol and drug issues, strongly related with these five leading causes of death, and there are others that we could list out here. And this is really key because we're changing the conversation. Instead of thinking of sort of clinical interventions to address heart disease, now you're talking about, well, how do we reduce alcohol and drug consumption? But that leads us to the next question, which is what's happening in the physical environment, physical, social, cultural environment that's shaping those exposures and behaviors, in this case, the use of alcohol. This is from Tennessee, where it's legal to drive up and buy whiskey. So is that a factor? Is that contributing to the use of alcohol in the community? And we see this in Oakland. Stores, what's being sold in local community stores, how much easier it is to get alcohol than it is to get a fresh piece of fruit. We've done some work with the Office of Minority Health to develop a tool called Thrive, Toolkit for Health and Resilience in Vulnerable Environments, which lays out kind of a menu of community health factors that shape the community environment and those actual causes, exposures, and behaviors. So in our group, our 35 leaders, we walked through this process and had people individually actually, we were focusing on alcohol and illicit drugs, individually think through, well, what are the community factors that are most strongly related to alcohol and drug abuse? And we tabulated the results after everybody had filled this out and came up with, there are actually four of them, parks and open space, arts and culture, what's sold and how it's promoted, and look, feel, and safety was the fourth one. And then we had people get into groups, into these four clusters, and think through, when you think from the perspective of alcohol and illicit drug use, what are the actual factors in a community? What does it look like? What are the things that we should be focusing on in order to reduce alcohol and drug consumption? So this was one particular group. So there were four groups, but I'm going to run through this one. So the Look, Feel, and Safety group identified three particular strategies that they were really interested in. One was reduced alcohol retail density. The second was creating safe public spaces to be active. And the third was livable community design. So interesting, but this is it was a cross-sectoral group. So people who were interested in parks sort of had a park lens on this question. And what we realized at this point, and in reflecting on it, was that a lot of us talk about sort of moving upstream, and people are following the river, and that's where you apply services. We need to move up and fix the bridge, and that's where the primary prevention happens. And what we realized was that in this instance, what we were really trying to push towards was actually what happens when you get to the bridge. Because often you're downstream with your sort of natural allies, let's say people who work on diabetes, and you say, okay, well, we all work on diabetes. Let's move upstream and figure out, and let's get to park access, because that's the thing that's happening in this community that's increasing diabetes. And what we were really pushing to was, okay, who else is there? When you get to the bridge, who else is thinking about park access? And what can you do to work with them effectively? So I'm going to go through one specific, so they then took these specific strategies and went a little bit deeper with them. So they looked at, one of the issues they looked at was alcohol density. And this is an example from South LA and the community coalition there, which we worked closely with over the years, who were able to shut down 200 liquor stores. And we're also able to document a 27% reduction in crime within a four-block radius. So we had these smaller groups use a tool called Collaboration Multiplier to sort through how different sectors would come to this issue and potentially work together on the issue. And so they identified four: alcohol and drug, nutrition, physical activity, violence prevention, and mental health. And they kind of role-played these different sectors to figure out what it was that they brought to this issue. And I won't go through, given my limited time, kind of what they actually laid out, although if anybody's interested in how they thought through the issue, I can share that with you. And then we had them, so they each played out, for each of these four sectors, what the expertise, desired outcomes, key strategies they brought, and then they put it together into this middle section of how they would work together. So what are the shared outcomes? How do they come to this issue conceptually? Well, they're all interested in healthier, safer people. They're all looking at for retail options that encourage healthy choices. And they're all interested in community members engaging in identifying and addressing the issues that most that are most important to them, the highest priority issues. In terms of their strengths, they have a subject matter expertise and credibility across these different issues. There are established community relationships and institutional partners that each of them brings. They all have funding, various levels of funding to do this sort of work. And in terms of the strategies that they identify that they all could agree on potentially were that they could have an influence on land use decisions, zoning decisions related to alcohol. They could produce data on the cumulative impact of alcohol in the community, something that I think sort of came out of this meeting was a real need to be able to say not just the impact, the direct impact, but the impacts more broadly on a whole wide range of health issues, kind of back to that two steps prevention framework. They could align a range of community organizations and leaders behind a strategy, and they could work with businesses who are interested in converting to healthier products in their businesses. So that's sort of, you know, we went through this. There were, as you can see, there were four groups. Each one did this for a couple of different issues. So there was a lot of information here. And then there was a sort of discussion about what the key points were to take away from this. And so here there are five that really emerged for me. One, for those of you who aren't from California, there's a process going on in California to look at health in all policies, so to look at state policymaking with kind of a health lens across different sectors. Alcohol and drug, not at the table, not even being considered in any of these. So one of the things was let's get alcohol and drug issues into the conversation in the health in all policies process. Second is to identify a core set of alcohol and drug prevention indicators across fields that would apply in public health planning education so that there can be a bit of a conversation about shared outcomes. Next is to develop a thorough cost analysis of alcohol and drug prevention so that we could really say that reducing alcohol and drug consumption would have a broad range of outcomes. Fourth was to convene leaders of key public health initiatives. So in California, we have a healthy eating, active living set of communities. There's a community transformation grants process, both in localities and statewide. And so there's a need to look at those processes and their priorities in relation to alcohol and drug issues. And the last, which is really where we started, was to establish a clear identity for alcohol and drug prevention that is separate from services. And we've seen this ongoing. There's now a conversation about whether alcohol and drug prevention services is going to go, prevention is going to go into public health or into health services. And in order to kind of articulate a vision about alcohol and drug prevention, it requires kind of really defining what that means, creating a sort of set of strategies, a face for alcohol and drug prevention that requires an alignment with other prevention activities. And so all of this, and it amounted to us, we got a real sense of sort of momentum in people and excitement at the idea that, you know, as you go to a community level and a strategy level, there are these opportunities for synergy and partnership and what we kind of put under the umbrella of a good solution solves multiple problems. And this is us on our website.
I'm going to ask our panelists to come up front and we'll use this time to get questions from our audience. I'm free.
Since you called me out, I'm going to ask you that. I thought that might happen. I think you did a very nice job of presenting what we talked about at the state that day, the pharmaceutical drug programs. So what's happened since? I actually think the reason that DADP did all that was because of the last line in your slot. Where do we put prevention in the reorganization that's now going on in the state? Does it stay with alcohol treatment services and go to essentially mental health, or does it go to public health? And if it goes to public health, why should it go to public health rather than mental health? Now, several of us in the room and the whole prevention community in California has a bunch of good reasons why alcohol drugs should go to public health in the state of California rather than to mental health, which is associated with treatment. And we came up with several reasons why. some of which were in your presentation there, but they were clothed in highly general statements, so they're hard to take out for specific actions. So I was curious, what happened? Did they keep working with the Prevention Institute? Because those members of the panel, who were the workshop were there, we have heard nothing back. At least I haven't. I mean, maybe they must not on the list. The other thing I think the state did there, or wanted to do there, was to bring in other state partners. They left out two of the most important state partners. The Department of Alcoholic Beverage Control was nowhere to be seen, nor was the State Board of Equalization, which is the key agency in California responsible for collecting taxes, and which is a key agency for looking at issues of taxation prevention, and which has been ducking doing that for a long time. So I'm going to just throw the ball back to you. Where all this going, and what are your thoughts about how you take your approach, which is, you know, quite an intriguing one, and deal with this kind of intractable morass of resistance to really facing up to some serious conceptual issues that lead to serious policy changes?
Ooh. Yeah, so I anticipated that you might ask the question.
Well, you didn't have to call me up.
That's okay. So partly there were some other specifics, and, you know, I was definitely trying for those who aren't in, you know, totally immersed in the California landscape and what's happening, except in sort of general. But, you know, but I think so it's really interesting, and I think there. A couple of things. I mean, one, we anticipate there was going to be a lot more follow-up, and I think partly because there was all of this sort of political, there was an almost immediate sort of political crisis about what was going to happen to AAP, which we sort of knew was coming, but it came faster, and it was a little more dramatic than they thought. So our traction and sort of and their responsiveness disappeared pretty quickly. That said, there's a real need for engagement. I mean, whether it's, I don't expect that ADP is actually going to provide the leadership. There needs to be leadership from outside. And I think actually one of the things that we were really interested in, and you know, you mentioned a couple of the departments, I mean, not knowing the alcohol and drug landscape, those are things that we should have pushed them on probably before, you know, we held the meeting. They handled the which departments made sense. So that's actually interesting to hear. But there's not a robust alcohol and drug prevention advocacy community, you know, there, which was interesting and surprising. I mean, if this was tobacco control, we could get 50 people to a meeting. If this had to do with nutrition issues, we could get 250 people to a state hearing. Alcohol and drug, it was hard for us to get anybody. There are maybe two or three, you know, there are a couple of research groups, and there are a couple, there's one or two advocacy groups, alcohol justice. So the landscape is not, you know, isn't that fertile. That said, there's an enormous need. I mean, right, the budgetary proposal to move alcohol and drug prevention to public health was tabled, and it's going to come up again in the next cycle. And so there's a real need, I think, to push for that. I mean, you know, state government isn't necessarily the best venue for this perspective or to act on it, but it is important that there be some alignment, and that's just going to get lost on the service and mental health side if it gets shuffled there. So, I mean, we can have I'd like to have a conversation because we need to figure out what the strategy is and how to actually have some influence in that process.
I want to offer one final comment that relates to the theme of this session, and that is, I think one of the reasons there's such weak representation, either by agencies or by advocates, is that there is essentially no good social epidemiology of alcohol in the state of California. California has basically abandoned its epidemiological duties. It has pretty good treatment information, which it has to have to get federal funding, but it has nothing about prevalence and incidence of problematic alcohol and drug behaviors in the community, in various community settings, and no interest that I can detect in developing that kind of category of knowledge about the distribution of alcohol problems and drug problems in the communities in different settings among different groups, aside from their treatment system.
Are there other questions from the audience?
Yeah. Jeremy, do you have those tools on your website that you used with this group in having those conversations with all the different players? And I think that would be great because I come more from a community level than a state level, and as we know, public health tends to get planned that way, or has been, and can work well that way. But that's what we're always saying, is like, let's get out of our silos, let's work together, what can we agree on? And that the land use is very exciting, because I'm from New York State, and we have really stiff preemption there, where you can't do a thing locally without outlet density. So we're thinking about the same thing, going in and using land use ordinance to deal with that. But it's great to hear that others in other fields, obesity, you know, working on obesity and tobacco are also.
So they are on our website, although you should probably just give me your card, yeah, and I'll package them for you and send them to you. They're also, we have a local policy database that sort of collects model policies around a range of issues from across the country, and there are a number of them that relate to alcohol density, so I can include a link to those as well.
Great.
Yeah. I have a question, just given the conversation that's been going on, and now have a question for Megan, Sarah, and Aaron, about thinking about your work and what you presented in terms of retailers and the contribution to alcohol, stressful life events, and social networks. If you can think of what you presented and how that can be used in terms of prevention or treatment or anything, any comment related to that? Because we got the results, but what to do with it?
I think for the American Indian population, it's difficult because Indian country is very complex, and there's many laws that are hard because it's the intersection of these sovereign nations who, even though we call them sovereign nations, in many ways they don't have the full rights of nations, and it depends from tribe to tribe. There's some are under different sets of laws, and so. So it's very complex. So, you know, they can regulate sales on their own land, but just across the border, they, you know, have no jurisdiction. And there's also a complicated relationship with alcohol because the tribes depend on tourism for their income, for their nations. And so if they, you know, people like to drink when they go on vacation, and so if they put limits on the alcohol retail environment, then that might hurt their income as a nation. So it's very complicated. And then, you know, they can work with the counties nearby and retailers there, but, you know, that's, sometimes their relationships are good, sometimes they're not so good. It's a really good question. I've thought about that myself. How can this information be used? And I'm really not sure. So. Yeah.
Yes, Aaron.
Regarding my study, I'm not sure that there's a lot to recommend at this point, except for there's some level of relocation counseling for people who are involved in PIMSIDS, sort of caseworkers that are supposed to help people select voucher-qualified landlord. And I think over time we'll have a better sense of what sorts of social connections are important. There's a study that's already been published related to this that showed that there's some access to healthcare problems, and there's sort of aspects of it that could be built into any sort of relocation counseling. Some sort of network analog actually could be used in terms of counseling people and helping them choose locations within Atlanta that might offer them the best access to social supports and access to health services, particularly people that have important health concerns and issues with public transportation and getting to where they need to go. choosing where you're going to rent when during this time of, you know, where this policy is sort of forcing you to move. I mean, I think that there could be just a little bit of additional counseling that sort of refers to some of the studies, the findings that are coming out of our study.
It's also that when we do more studies like that, it's information that can be given to public health departments that this might be a critical period for me to be in when someone is moving from a neighborhood, whether good or bad, to a different one. Like when a group's being moved at the same time, you have enough that to start thinking about maybe something for public health departments to think about.
Yeah, absolutely. I think over time, the study will be able to sort of provide a lot of good information for people who score high on their NPC or versus people that don't. There needs to be, and every time there will be, some sort of subgroup analyses to see if there's a certain sort of recommendations for certain risk profiles versus others. And I hate to oversimplify the OTIC study because there's a subset of people, not everyone declined, well, not all direct people who are scoring on the drug dependency scale went down over time. Of course, there's some subset that went 2, 3, 4 points higher 6 months after. So, you know, after a few more waves of data, we'll really be able to sort of separate out groups that seem to be doing better or worse.
I think that certainly identifying resources, as you said, especially when people are more susceptible or vulnerable, no matter what the study is useful. I mean, I think for our study, stressful life events, define them as you will, have been around since forever. Likewise, in the French population, where drinking is quite commonplace, that's been around forever. What we're seeing now, as we are in France with obesity over the last couple of decades, is things are changing. Well, what is it that's changing? Is it stressful life events? No. Is it culture? Are the norms changing? So I think really doing additional research to finding out why things are going in that direction and then establishing resources to help people when they're most vulnerable to limit the bad practice.
Are there other questions?
Yeah. For Megan, I have a question about the fatality, so the rates are higher. I'm wondering, I know that there's some research that show that Native populations have higher rates of not using seatbelts.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, did you have that data on the reports or is it something that you think might be related at all anecdotally? Or?
That information is on the reports. We didn't ask for that at the time, but I think that would make a difference. And I've heard from communities that it's very common for people not to wear seatbelts as well. So I think that would be a factor that would be important to look at. Yeah, car seats as well for babies and kids. That's another issue.
Yeah.
Yes. For Aaron, do you think, I know you're still analyzing, but on the, let's say the groups that you have that have less support from the get-go, like people who are sort of have only one or two connections to that type of thing, do you think that the people on the lower ends, when they're moving, they're more sort of susceptible to changes? Like if you try to think of you have someone who has, maybe one person in that one, they get more, or you have someone with zero, and they get one, maybe they're more susceptible to certain behaviors. Maybe that's an intervention point. If you just have one person who's in your life who's very, alcohol dependent, then you go, maybe it's an intervention point when you have a new, network or lost that. And, so just wondering if you've thought that on the extreme ends, if this is sort of a group that is more susceptible to change than maybe susceptible to interventions.
That's my hypothesis, I guess. And one of the things that I'm interested in doing, that I wasn't interested in about 2 weeks ago, is actually just relooking at this data in terms of nesting within social networks. So it's kind of obvious that we should be doing that. But the study's designed to look at community level and nesting within census tracts over time in those levels. But you could also, instead of nesting within 7 census tracts, which will be more over time, you can nest within 1 versus 2 versus 3 social network members at baseline
or there's different ways to address that question, but it's an interesting question, and I don't know if I have an answer, but yeah, I guess it's definitely interesting looking at that, and whether people may nominate someone at times too that they trust financially, if that's related to the number of people they start with in terms of social support links. Yeah.
Sure, this time.
Sarah, I'm wondering about if in this study there's any sort of questions that will ever be used in a sense like of people's like subjective rating of the stressful event, like because you know I was thinking some of them I think most people universally accept as like stressful bad, but you know maybe a retirement for some people will be good, some people will be bad. I'm wondering especially for the women, not because, but just because they seem to have less effects compared to some of the men in terms of, that might be something in play for them, or anything we comment on, maybe the valence of the event, if you think there's that's in play with this.
Sure. So, firstly, they don't have a question where they rate, unfortunately, the dichotomous yes, no. I certainly come across a number of studies like ours, which have shown that the effect of stressful life events on health, not just alcohol, is more dire, if you will, for men than it is for women, which I think speaks to some other literature on marriage and being married. So I think it would be really interesting to parse that out. Why is that? I have perhaps some ideas, but we're not able to look at that. But I would think that would be definitely something that would be important to look at.
Okay. Well, we'd like to thank our panelists one more time. And we'd like to thank you for coming.